Next concept. Think Twins separated at birth. Extra credit for anybody who can name this movie. Parent Trap. Anybody know what year? 61. Pretty close. Okay, Haley Mills is the actor, right? Two girls separated at birth. And think of the stories that you've heard about twins, right? Like Haley Mills. They both grow up. They both marry a guy named Bob. Both love color blue. They both work in IT. One of them goes skiing, falls down, breaks her leg. At the same time, half a continent away, the other one trips on the curb and breaks her leg, right? It seems that no matter what one does, the other one does the same thing. Well, Niels Bohr and Aaron Schrödinger theorized that this happens with quantum, at the quantum level. Two particles, two photons, for instance, which are just little packets of light, or two electrons, but they were connected together once, and say they were on both electrons from the same atom, and then you blow off these electrons, or you blow off photons in different directions, and then you tweak one of them. And what happens? Simultaneously, the other one tweaks. So they move either in concert or in opposite directions. The key on this, though, is it's simultaneous. So we blow these two things apart. They were once connected, blown apart, tweak one, and the other one moves. Okay. Our buddy, Albert Einstein, he hated this concept. Absolutely hated it. Because for him, relativity was all about how things are in relationship to each other. And he believed, because of his theory, that the fastest, because if you've got one electron over here and one of them over here, and if you tweak one, the fastest one that this one should move is at the speed of light. Because some sort of information would have to move from here to here that says, turn right. That isn't what happens in quantum theory. They move exactly, simultaneously. He hated that, and he called it spooky action at a distance. He hated spooky action at a distance. To his dying day, he could not get over the fact that what quantum theory, which he helped create back in 1905, the results of what some of his work meant was that things would move faster than the speed of light, that there's some sort of information that makes things move. So now, many years later, a Frenchman, Alain Aspect, 1982, does this experiment where he can actually, now in 1982, have the ability to measure it. Didn't back before. And he shows that if you take an atom called S, you shoot off photons in either direction, tweak one, the other one's working. He measured it and said that information can move faster than the speed of light, but there is no boundary to how fast things can move. Okay, so now we've got a problem. Two of the foundations of classical Newtonian physics, remember Newton with the bad long hair? That influence occurs only over time and distance. Not true anymore in quantum physics. You can move two electrons no matter how far apart they are, and they will move in concert. Second, which is that two particles, if you've got an electron here and an electron here, they're independent, right? They're two different things. No. Once they've been together, they contain information, and you can tweak them. So they act like they're still part of the whole entangled twin thing. Recently, what's happened in 2003, Thomas Dirt from Brussels says that almost all quantum interactions produce entanglement. Almost all. Photons are entangled. So a photon, say you got a star way out there, Alpha Centauri, you know, and it's beaming little packets of light towards Earth. Every atom that it comes in contact with on the way to Earth, it is entangled with. Benny from Tel Aviv University says, every interaction between every electron inside us, this is our physical body now that he's measuring, creates entanglement. So all of our atoms and electrons are entangled because they're in this body that is ours. And then he said something even interesting, back to you, even empty space around us is heaving with entangled particles. Paul Dirac says, empty space, there's no such thing. You can tip all the matter out of space, create an absolute vacuum. There's nothing in it. Underneath that, in the vacuum of space, in that nothingness, is a netherworld teeming with subatomic activity. Okay, so what are these subatomic things we're talking about? Well, at the beginning, we've got protons, neutrons, and electrons. Remember, this is Newtonian stuff here. And then what they discovered earlier in this century was that each one of these is made up of subatomic particles. And on the plane here, I was reading an article about a guy who just discovered another subatomic particle. Well, there was a time in the 60s when you discovered a subatomic particle, you got a Nobel Prize in physics. Well, this is like the 37th subatomic particle. He said, you know, what I got? I got a $50 gift certificate from the university, and I had to buy the coffee for the week. It's like no big deal. There's so many different kinds of subatomic particles. And the picture on the right shows them as kind of like little billiard balls where they bang into each other. Not necessarily the case. Because the quantum guys say, well, it's not... We draw it like that to try to explain, but it's more like that last picture, which is there's this field of energy that is something or it isn't something. But subatomic particles, what they do is they kind of just run into each other and they exchange energy. It's not really a thing so much as it's this little packet of energy that gets exchanged back and forth. Okay, this is the best, sorry for the sports metaphor, but this is the best I could do. That these packets of energy are you know, move back and forth. And all these elementary particles, the subatomic particles I'm describing, interact with each other by exchanging energy. And they use virtual atomic particles to do it. That's the vehicle for exchanging this energy. The knots appear and disappear seemingly out of nowhere. In this area, in this subatomic world, where there's all of this potential, all of these things just sit out there, when they exchange energy, it's known as zero-point energy. And even at absolute zero, where there shouldn't be anything moving, because all energy, theoretically, is out of the system, because at the coldest it will ever be, no energy there, it's kind of by definition. These tiny fluctuations are still visible, they're still popping in and out of existence. Scott's description, okay? It's as if the subatomic particles sit in another dimension and they don't care how cold it is. That's over here. And when they exchange a little packet of energy, it's like they pop into our dimension, do their thing, and then move out. And so it's just, and that's all they do.
These 11 dimensions you were talking about earlier, they feed back and forth.
They
feed back and forth. Energy has to flow. It cannot stop.
Cannot stop it. So, here's the deal. How much energy is in this subatomic realm? Is in a picture, remember, a void? There's nothing in space, but it's teeming with subatomic activity. Take a cubic meter. All right, I'm going to try to do this. High, wide, deep. A cubic meter of totally empty space. With me? There's enough energy in that cubic meter of totally matter-free space to boil all of the oceans on Earth. One cubic meter of empty space. They say, picture, if you can picture all of the physical energy that's represented by our physical universe, that the non-physical energy is 10 to the 40th. That's a 1 followed by 40 zeros. 10 to the 40th bigger. Amazing amount of energy that exists at the subatomic level in this place where we can't see. So, what's the point about zero point? I've led you down this road for a reason. I've given you a bunch of definitions because this guy, Hal Puthoff, has been studying zero point energy for 30 years. And his explanation of what zero-point energy does for us is that it maintains the stability of the hydrogen atom. It is what keeps it in its shape. And because hydrogen is the simplest of all atoms, one proton and one electron, it is the basis from which all physical matter is created. So if zero-point energy is interacting with hydrogen atoms to keep it stable, that means it's keeping all of physical matter stable. And in addition, It's responsible for two of the basic properties of mass, inertia, and gravity. So here's what I want you to picture. There's a little thought experiment. We have two sticks that are sitting in the sand. And this big wave comes and hits the sticks, and the sticks go down. Everybody with me on this one? If you're looking at this from an observer, you go, those sticks went down simultaneously. But what if you don't know about and can't see the wave? You would say that there's a non-local effect, that the two sticks are entangled. This is one of the explanations for entanglement, is the zero-point energy field. That because it connects with every piece of physical matter, is what holds it together. Of course they would go down, because they're always talking to the zero-point energy field. There's this wave that's created by zero-point energy that hooks everything together, makes this invisible connection that exists with everything in the universe. Explanation number two about entanglement is this. At the Big Bang, all matter, all physical matter in the universe was compressed, I've heard, to the size of a speck of dust, to a grain of sand, or to the size of a pea. It's that range somewhere. Every piece of physical matter compressed to this size. And at this point, there is no such thing as space. It is one single unit of matter. And then what happened at the Big Bang was, space was invented. Space was inserted into matter, and thus everything in the universe is that one piece of matter blown big that now has space between it. And thus, because it was once one thing, everything still talks to each other. Explanation number two. Okay, so what's the next step? We now know that scientists have proved that there's this invisible energy field and that all matter somehow relates to it. At what scale does this entanglement apply experimentally? You remember Alain Aspect. He did it in 1982, but when he measured it, it was really small. I mean, it was a pretty tiny little experiment. Viedril and Zeilinger in 2004 did this experiment, but underneath the Danube River, they connected two different points, and they took an atom and they split it. They shot off photons in both directions and then tweaked them when they got to either side of the river, and entanglement happened. There was 600 meters of river between the two photons, and they still operated. They weren't within sight of each other. There was massive amounts of material in between the two of them, and they still showed entanglement. We enter another part of this, which is, what is matter really? What is matter really? And for this, I need to take you back to 1801, a guy by the name of Thomas Young. He's a professor of physics at the University of Cambridge, and what he is trying to do is to figure out, is light a particle or a wave? And what he does is he has a light source, he creates a barrier with two slits in it, and he said, like this golfer here with the golf balls, if light is consistent of particles, when you hit you shoot off the particles off the tee, it should go through this slit and look like that on the back wall. Right? It's made of particles. Is that what happened? No. This is what happened. It came through and it acted like a wave. And then went through the double slits. And because now we have waves from the double slits, they interfere with each other. And when they interfere with each other, they create this dark light pattern, which blown up looks like that. So when a wave moves through a double slit, it has this dark light pattern, or if it moves through a slit as a particle, it would look like that. Right? So one of them has bars and one of them has the two clean things. Fast forward 100 years, 1909. British physicist Geoffrey Ingram Taylor says, we now have the ability to shoot electrons through slits. So why don't we try this experiment again and see what happens? We know what we shoot off of the tee. It's an electron, or it could be a photon, but let's take electron. We shoot that baby through the slit, and so he sets it up in two stages. The first stage was one slit. So picture this one up here with one slit. Okay, and we got the golfer there. It hits He hits that electron, goes through the one slit, and what happens on the other side of the wall? You get exactly that picture. Starts out as a particle, goes through the slit. They got a little measuring device. It says, yes, it went through the slit, hits the back wall, creates this particle thing. Okay, now we're ready for part two. We're going to put two slits in and see if the same thing applies. What do you think happens? We hit off an electron. We know it's an electron. We know it's a particle. It travels as a particle, sees two slits. The detector at the slits measures the same particle going through this two slits simultaneously. We shut off one particle, two go through the slits. And then it recombines into a particle on the other side. We've got a particle that starts out as a particle, goes through the slits like a wave, but that's the only, and then recombines to join a particle again.
Time, when did this happen?
Early to mid-1900s.
This? Yeah. With the electrons? Huh?
Yeah. It gets weirder, hang on. Okay, so when they do this, they say, what happened? What was the difference? How can you start something out as a particle when it hits the wall as a wave going through the two slits? Sometimes it recombines into a particle, and frankly, sometimes it shows up on the wall as those bands. Why? How does that happen? The explanation that comes is that, I want to quote this, the electron somehow perceives that the second opening exists and is available and changes its form. Now, the premise that we have to go with is, or at least the premise that's in science right now, is the electrons have no consciousness. I mean, they're like smart little things. And therefore, that for it to recognize that there are two openings for the electron to go through means that some other form of organizing principle exists. And the only other organizing principle that exists in the room is the observer. The observer, by observing the experiment, the electron enables it to go through two slits. Did I tell you it's going to get weird? Because we observe it, matter changed form in order to do what it could do. Quote, knowledge of the electron has two possible paths to move through the slits is in the mind of the observer, and that's the onlooker's consciousness is what determines how the electron travels. It is consciousness that changes what happens at the electron. Consciousness is the director. We now have two sets of rules, which is we have the classical set of rules and we've got the quantum set of rules, which have this, what's known in the business as quantum weirdness. This observer effect, known as quantum weirdness, and it plays a key role in the universe. Okay, there's a term for this. It's called superposition. This idea that a particle can exist in some sort of indeterminate state. It's not a particle, it's not a wave. And it's only upon when we look at it, when we bring our consciousness to the experiment, that it actually collapses into one of those states. Is it a particle, is it a wave? It depends upon the observer. All right, so now we're up against a huge giant in the world of physics and science, and that is Rene Descartes, who, by the way, is the only person who knows how to get a comb and maybe some conditioner. It looks pretty good for a guy, don't you think? His premise is that mind is separate and somehow different from matter, that consciousness is generated entirely by the brain and is locked up in the skull. This has been with us since the 17th century. It's what Rene said was the truth, and this is how we've operated our lives up until recently. And I'm talking, you guys saw, I mean, this is 2003 forward. It has been theoretically described before now, experimentally confirmed within just these last few years.
Okay, can I say something?
Of course you can say something. Have I ever stopped you before?
But research has also proven in the last 2 years that consciousness is no longer in the brain, it is in the heart. It is the heart that sends it to the brain.
And it has proven that it doesn't exist in, that consciousness is not seated in the brain. On the IONS website,
that's true too.
Pim Lamp Van Lommel did an amazing study with cardiac patients. Fabulous study over 8 years, hundreds of people. I urge you to read it, which we'll talk about in question and answer if you want. Okay, so we have this problem, which is we have this history here with Renee that we have to blow out of the water because it doesn't fit with our experience anymore. So remember Zeilinger, he's the guy with the river experiment. So then he said to himself, well, how big a thing can I send through that double slit experiment and see what happens? Because right now all we've done is photons and electrons. So he said, well, how about a molecule? You know, a group of atoms. So the first one he picks is the fullerene, which is affectionately known as the buckyball, named after Buckminster Fuller. He used the fullerene as his model for the geodesic dome. Okay. 60 atoms. This is a behemoth in the world of atoms. This is a big boy. Okay? So he does the same thing. He puts it on the tee, hits it off, goes through the slit, there's a particle. Boom. Puts the tube, hits it off through the slit. What happens? Wave. Comes up as those interference patterns on the second one. A molecule, 60 atoms big, goes through the two slits as a wave. Now remember, the definition of a molecule is something that can only be broken down by chemical action. Let me remember that from your 8th grade science.
Yeah.
Oh, good. You guys get extra credit. Here, all we did was present it with two slits, and it changed form. So now he's saying to himself, okay, maybe it's because it looks like a soccer ball and it's cute. Let's take something ugly. So he took chlorinated fluoride, which is the one on the bottom left. It's flat, looks like a pancake, got these kind of little green knobbies on it. And he said, no, it's not round, it's got knobs. It's even bigger, 70 atoms. Hits it off the tee, what happens? Wave. He's blown away. And he says, okay, I'm going to pick one of the largest atoms on the planet. And I have to read this to you. Tetraphenyl porphyrin. It's a bio dye in chlorophyll. It's gargantuan. It's 100 atoms. It's gnarly. You know, it's got little spikes on everything. He said, if anything's going to catch and create problems, that's it. It's probably one of the biggest atoms that's on the planet. Okay. Guess what? Changed its form. It went through the double slits as a wave, which says that science has now proven that matter is not stable, that it can change its form based on consciousness of the observer. Can we say that again? Physical matter is not stable like we once thought it was. That some of the largest molecules on the planet change their form based on the consciousness of the observer. Yes, sir.
Several physicists have become spiritualists after observing quantum mechanics.
Oh, yeah. They're all weird right now. This was published in 2005. I want to take you back to the original experiment. Remember Shree, the 26-year-old? The molecule that she was observing that acted as an independent unit after applying all of that energy, the level at which that acted was a billion billion atoms. That's how big it was, that reacted as an entangled mass, bigger than anything so far. Okay. Then the connection was so strong that it overrode the classical influences. Okay. World religions. I'm not going to spend a lot of time. On the left, and Indra, Hindu, the quote on this one is, far away, this is from the sutras, far away in the heavenly abode of the great god Indra, there is a wonderful net, which has been hung by some cunning artificer in such a manner that it stretches infinitely in all directions. The one in the center is from the American Indian tradition, Spider Grandmother, who emerged into the emptiness of this world. The first thing she did was to spin the great web that connects all things. And through it, she created a place where her children would live their lives. The ancient Greeks called it ether. This is the universal field of energy that connects everything, simply referred to as E-T-H-E-R or A-E-T-H-E-R. Even Aristotle, if you remember back then, they described that everything was made out of earth, air, fire, and water. And then he added a fifth one, ether. Okay, so does consciousness really affect physical matter? That's the point where we're at right now. And so there's four experiments I want to talk to you about very quickly. At the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Laboratory, they did this one. Over 25 years, they had an experiment where you sat in front of a computer screen, and with a random generator, it would show you either a picture of an Indian, a pleasant picture of an Indian, or a pleasant picture of a cowboy. I picked these off the webs. This isn't the ones they used, but you get the idea. And the idea was they told the people who were sitting there, please, you know, try to bring up one or bring up the other. And the results of that showed conclusively that human intervention can influence it to a statistically significant degree. Two, I love this experiment. It took a group of chicks, you know, little baby chicks. And remember your biology class? When chicks are first born, they imprint upon the mother. So there's one hen that they imprint. Well, what they did, these chicks were born, and they took a stuffed chicken and they stuck it on top of a robot, like a Roomba. You know, those robots that go around your living room and clean everything up. So you got that picture in your head? And so the chicks imprinted on this stuffed chicken. And then they put a random generator into this Roomba kind of robot and set the cage in one corner. And theoretically, you know, the robot should visit every area of the room equally because it's a random generator. Nope. 2.5 times more likely to be by the chicks. So it's not human consciousness, it's consciousness that affected the robot. So these little chicks, you know, they're lonely, they want their mother. Please come closer. You know, that's kind of what happened there. The robot did. Amazing results here. 73 studies representing 2,500 people, 2.5 million throws of dice, and they were able to get people to throw, like snake eyes or whatever, and the odds against what they did was 1 with 76 zeros to 1. Big result. How many of you remember Uri Geller? Okay, he's the guy who did spoon bending. And so what they did is they took children, put them in a room, then they hung keys from the ceiling with that little wire, and the wires went to a lead to a machine that measured voltage and movement and all kinds of stuff. They said, go to it, kids. Well, I don't know if you can, this is blowing up too big. But that's one of the bent keys. And not only that, some of the keys were fractured. At some point, there was this gauge right here. This is where they tested it. Going along, going along, going along. Boom! 10 volts. That was the limit to the gauge that they used. It was as high as it could go. So here are a bunch of kids. They're 3 to 10 feet away from keys, so they can't touch the keys. And all they're told is to bend the keys. The keys swayed, they broke, they bent, they registered electricity. And I think what's really cool is they would put one child into a room and then they hung a whole bunch of keys and said, bend them. And all the keys simultaneously registered an electrical charge. So the idea that thought can go anywhere at any time. Is there something to this?
Yes.
And the answer was yes. That consciousness can affect physical matter at a distance. My last quote. When we understand us, our consciousness, we also understand the universe, and the separation disappears. And so what happens is that near-death experiencers are describing the universe. Ancient religions have described the universe, and scientists have described the universe in what I would consider to be very, very similar ways. and thank you for your kind attention.
Are we going to have time for questions?
We've got about 7 minutes, I guess.
As I was listening to your presentation, all of a sudden this thought came. Can the near-death experiences that we have, can they just be the thing that is thrusting us forward to be that which we are and always have been? That's what I'm getting from your presentation.
Thank you very much.
What I get out of this is the intention, mass intention, how we can affect others.
Yes.
Could you expand on that perhaps a little, on your thoughts?
Well, mass intention has got us to where we are today. I mean, the whole idea that Newton was able to step in there, or Rene Descartes, and say that we are separate, and that we live in a world where we are separate from each other, in fact, it described how we looked at the universe for 200 years. And now, scientists are saying, whoa, we have this whole entanglement thing. We're not separate from the universe. The very fact that we are conscious and observing changes matter. We have to reorient ourselves based on what Zeilinger was doing with these huge molecules. If we can do that to these big molecules, well, what else can we do to them? That's where we are now. We're like little babies in terms of how intention can be brought forth. And there have been some large-scale experiments with that just at the beginning of that, especially like prayer studies. There have been a whole zillion of those.
I'm a firm believer in mass apostolic thinking, meaning, you know, that we are entangled within, you know, a mass apostolic thinking of all of us together, entangled all together. And it always makes me chuckle when someone says, oh, this planet or this universe is how many light years away. The question is, if we are the ultimate observer and we're all on a mass apostolic thinking, then the question then is that truly there, or is it our mass apostolic thinking? Are we making the stars? Are we making these universes so far away that it's always been in our thought? Because thought travels a lot faster than mind, so our thinking has already created what always has been. It's just coming into view. Does that make sense? Through mass apostolic thinking?
Yes, it makes sense, and I can't comment on that. That's makes my head hurt. It's one of those really naughty problems.
Sort of a mixture of science and religion is when Jesus was healing, people would be around him and be healed.
Yes.
So you have the example of entanglement. They had such faith, they would connect with him. And the woman who had an issue of blood for 12 years, she just touched him with his garment. He said, who touched me? Peter said, everyone touched you. We're all here. He said, someone took some energy from me. And he praised her for it. You know, it's the faith that connects everything. So it is a mixture of religion and science.
To kind of bring this back into the realm of the near-death experience, what I was saying is that what a lot of people really struggle with around the near-death experience is death an ending or is it a beginning? What I'm gleaning from your presentation and some of the research that I've read is that what they're finding is that consciousness or the soul, whatever you want to call it, actually is that continuum that you're talking about. The presentation, what I've gained from that this evening is that science is now coming into conformity with what the premise of what religion has said over time and eternity is that death is a beginning, that the soul continues. You know, life is just part of that continuum.
Well done.
Something done when you were talking in your day job, you talk about the businessman being entangled with the customer, therefore you should look at it as a separate thing to be taken advantage of. I mean, do you use some of the same...
I don't use this language with them. They would freak out.
I don't mean that. I mean the part about being considerate of the other side. Yes.
But what I know is that where the head of the business owner is where the business is. If the business owner is in a strange place or he's down, wherever his consciousness is, that's where the business is. And so that whole idea about your personal attitude about your business has a tremendous impact on you, your employees, your customers, everyone around you. You know that old expression, like attracts like. That's what we're talking about here. And then, if you put some energy around visioning, you know, you talk about, how many of you have been in meetings where you got to sit through mission, vision, goals, objectives, right? Right? How many of you, I've seen some glazed eyes, good. Those are really hard meetings to go to. And the visioning part is critical. Where do we want to be in the future? Because we're sending that thing out to the void with all good luck. We'll start to come to us.
I just also want to ask a question. I don't recall you talking about your NDE.
I did not talk about my NDE.
About
1 minute. I got 1 minute to tell my story.
Yeah, I had a question. How do you determine what Jesus meant when he said, "Thy will be done, not mine"? Or what you see me do is what the Father, you see the Father.
Or John, right, where he talks about what you can do even more than what I can do.
Yeah.
Right? Okay, so now I'm stepping into religion, and this is the wonderful ability of God and grace. Because thank goodness I didn't get all my desires when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
Right? I was hormones and tennis shoes, and whatever I desired when it hit that field, some sort of grace, which I can't describe, filtered that so that I didn't get all that stuff that I wanted. That part, I have to just say, there's God's grace out there somewhere. Thank you very much. I should tell my near-death experience really quick then.
Yeah.
I had an empathetic or a shared near-death experiences, and that's very different than, essentially it's a near-death experience without the physical trauma. And it was because I was in love with a woman, her name was Mary Frances, and she and her son Nolan were in a car coming home from sailing lessons, and when she pulled out onto the highway, she happened to look into the setting sun and didn't see the car. And the car hit her right in the driver's side door. So Mary Fran was killed instantly. And Nolan was mortally wounded. He had a severe head trauma. In fact, when I saw the x-rays, it looked like a watermelon or a cantaloupe that had been dropped onto the ground. You know how it looks when it gets fractured like that? That's how his skull looked. And it took him about 5 days to make his transition. Because Nolan, or Mary Fran, was one of nine kids, and Nolan was the oldest grandchild, and it was a good Catholic family, and by the time the fifth day came, the room around Nolan was filled with relatives, 30, 40, I don't know, but we were all bedside. And because I was just the new boyfriend, you know, I was kind of back about 6 rows sitting on the windowsill. The best way that I can describe this is when Nolan flatlined, when he made his transition, Mary Fran came and picked up Nolan. And I could feel the embrace of mother and son. She came and embraced him, and at some point, she reached over and included me in that embrace. We left for the light. What makes this a little strange is that I bilocated. Remember it talks about those attributes? Because I was fully present with all of the grieving relatives. Let's face it, I mean, just seconds before, you know, their grandson, their nephew, their niece had just died, and it was an incredibly sad place, and I was fully present in the room with them. My consciousness left and went with them to the light. And at some point, I dropped off. They went further and I came back. It was the most amazing experience. Bliss, ecstasy, happiness. I've never been that full of wonder and joy. Entirely inappropriate for the room. Because I remember having to take and cover my face because I am so joyful, and everyone around me is in deep despair because they just lost Nolan. They lost Mary Fran 5 days before, and then they lost Nolan. So it was a real tragedy for this family, and I'm just all grins. So, I mean, I have to cover my face. It sent me on a spiritual quest. As you could probably imagine, I grew up Presbyterian, and in the Presbyterian church, this is not part of their lexicon. You know, this whole buy a little cake, go to the light with dead people thing, you know. It's not part of what they teach, so I didn't know what to do with the experience. Now, I've heard about near death experience, but it didn't apply to me. I didn't die. I didn't have anything physically wrong with me, other than I was grieving. It sent me on a path that eventually tied me up with PMH Atwater. In one of her books, there's a little bitty paragraph about an empathetic near-death experience, and I went, that's me. And I started reading about it, and I started researching it, and it's consumed my life. So that's the story.
Thank you. And you learned so much. And I'm lucky. I mean, I have a cool mom, you know?
Yeah.
I go to astronomy, and I go to physics, and I go, well, why can't we go back in time? Why the time doesn't exist? And the teacher goes, shh. I'm not supposed to ask that. And it's so wonderful to be able to see the reality of what I think all of us already know. And to have it be told to us while we're here in a way that we can understand, in a way that society has taught us, instead of thinking, oh, that person's weird. It makes sense to everyone. And the way that you convey this message would make sense to my friends where I can't explain. It passes a boundary, a social boundary. So, thank you.
That's the nicest compliment I've gotten in the
age. In all the people you've interviewed, is there a consistent majority that say anything about the future?
That's a really good question. I've had very few people. I think of all the people I've interviewed, I think only one asked about the fear. Everything else, because you have to remember that the near-death experience, in a large part, is about you coming back. Because we already know that they're coming back to the planet. The experience that you get there is what you need, at least that's how I view it, is what you need to come back. So they give you some, sometimes it's pleasant, sometimes it's a kick in the butt. But it's whatever you need to come back here in the physical universe so you can turn it up a notch. And sometimes it's an expansion and sometimes it's, you know, literally, it's like, and I know there are people who are out there that do that or have had that experience. I haven't talked to them personally, though. I've only read it in books.
During watching this slit thing and talking about the subatomic particles, I'm a little bit nervous to even talk about this, but I do quantum touch healing.
Oh, yeah.
And in a method that I've been taught, it uses a similar thing. Well, it's exactly the same thing. Where you, there's a chakra below each of our feet. If that chakra is spun, so you spin it, you can split it in two and it will go up the soles of the person's feet and up through the channels of the body into this single channel that runs down the center of our bodies, which is where all of our chakras lie. Mm-hmm. And they all stand like pearls on top of each other. When this chakra split, it comes back up into one inside that shaft and comes up and can be opened up here at the crown chakra. Thereby, I can go up and spin the upper chakras and bring them down inside to create a greater energy field. So it is the same thing where if I don't spin that chakra, it just sits there. I can't split it in two. It will stay one. But if I spin it and it becomes a wave, it will split in two and come up the person's body, thereby creating more energy. And also with the subatomic particles, when I go in, if someone is very tense and in a lot of pain, those particles will be stuck in clumps and not be moving like they really, really should be vibrating. If I go in and I move the energy and cause them to have a little space of energy between the, each of them so that they can vibrate and become fully filled with motion, then the pain is relieved and relaxation is the result, thereby allowing healing to take place.
Isn't that amazing? There's so many different paths for this. Thank you for that.